When you sort of come to Cafe Sydney, what you want is you want to have a whole lot of different backstories to your food, like anybody does. But the beauty of running something like that is that you can take up the production of one particular item from someone, or you can be one of a few people who get a particular product, because you can constantly support using all of it. And so you can create a very unique menu within the context of a high volume restaurant.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. There's a romantic notion about restaurants, and it's pinned to the vast majority that are local, family-run small venues where the owners pour their heart and soul into the business. But some restaurants are huge operations that rely on a big engine room of chefs and front of house to help create the heart and soul of major cities too. What sort of chef does it take to not only manage a huge team, but ensure customer satisfaction and repeat business too? James Kidman is the executive chef of Cafe Sydney in Sydney. James, how are you going?
Yeah, good, mate. How are you?
Good. You've worked in some pretty big venues over your entire career. Was that always a goal of yours to have such big kitchens and teams?
No, not at all. I mean, I think like most people, you start off with that dream that you're going to own a little, you know, local neighbourhood restaurant, but it just didn't transpire that way for whatever reason. And I sort of enjoyed doing the larger venues, and I think I sort of probably was better at them than probably the smaller venues where you've got, you know, a ton more support really happening, whether in the kitchen or the background. So, yeah, I think that's why.
We can look at all of the incredible venues that you've been part of that have helped shape the culinary landscape of Sydney and Canberra. But where did it all start for you? Where did you get an interest in food?
Easy. First of all, big family, four kids, three boys, playing lots of sport, always hungry. But I think one of the things was that back in the day, in the sort of late 70s and early 80s, Mum did a lot of cooking for the family. But she also, my dad was a banker, and we had a lot of entertaining going on at home because, you know, the restaurant scene wasn't what it is today. And she would have this budget of money for these elaborate sort of dinners that they would do. And she was cooking from, you know, the Cordon Bleu books or magazines, which she'd sort of bought, you know, a thing of every week, and they were in a big folder. Or, you know, she had Mastering the Art of French Cookery and all those sorts of things. And so we got the scraps, I suppose, of those dinners, what was left. But, and I remember all these sort of, yeah, just really beautiful French sort of cooking at home for these dinners. And Mum made a really big effort at home. We had these lovely Sunday lunches every week. And so that sort of, I think, sort of shaped my sort of love of food, really. And in all honesty, I mean, I almost left school when I was about 15 or 16 in Brisbane to take up a chef's apprenticeship. And I sort of got convinced otherwise, and to stay at school and, you know, get my HSC. I eventually came back down to Sydney, finished the last 2 years of school in Sydney, and a couple of failed attempts at university, you know, and I failed beautifully. I found myself one day, I was working for Christine Manfield in her first restaurant at the Phoenix Cafe, or Phoenix Restaurant in, or bistro, whatever it was called, at the top of the pub in Wallara. And, you know, I sort of saw what she was doing, and I kind of, it sort of ignited something in me. And I was scheduled to go away on this overseas trip over to Europe, which I ultimately did. And then I came back, and shortly after that, I sort of delved into the world of commercial cookery and becoming a chef, probably about the age of, I was either 23 or 24, something along those lines, and that's been it. So, yeah, so it's been a sort of varied sort of journey to sort of get there from school and to university, a few travels, and then doing dishes for a living. So it's been interesting.
That's a little bit older than many that enter the industry. What was it like being a 23, 24-year-old entering the industry when a lot enter at a younger age?
Look, I was pretty warmly received because the first place that I worked was a place called Trezzini's over in Mossman, which was, this big cafe sort of that had come up from Melbourne. And they were killing it in Mossman, and I sort of heard about it, and there was a job for an apprentice, and I sort of rocked up, just sort of coming back from overseas, and I was working for a market research company that I'd worked for a bit, and I sort of really wanted to get stuck into cooking, and I walked in and had an interview with who was my first head chef, Richard Moiser, and we sat down and we had this, really good chat. He asked me where I'd been, and I sort of told him where I'd been, we'd been to Amsterdam and done the whole Amsterdam thing, and he looked at me and smiled. And from that time on, I was sort of, he gave me an opportunity, and I just grabbed it. I loved it. It was, after about one day, I knew that that was where I was supposed to be, and he was just an amazing mentor and was a very good friend up until he died a year or so ago now. So, he was my first head chef. That was my first job, and it was awesome. It was just great.
What did you take from that time in that kitchen?
Oh, I think probably just the love of food is probably the big thing. Richard would suggest places that I should go eat. He would he'd bring me in all sorts of cookbooks to look at. It was just a place where, I was working with someone who just loved the industry, who loved to cook, and he really mentored me, and he continued to be a sounding board for any job that I'd do in the future, whether that had been while I was an apprentice or when I sort of went on to much more senior roles. He was always the first person that I'd give a call to and have a chat about it.
You made a real name for yourself as executive chef at Otto over almost a decade, winning many accolades. What was the real inspirations before that time for you?
I had three really amazing jobs. After, I suppose, the latter stage of my apprenticeship, I spent a couple of years working for Anthony Massara in Sydney at what was the Pavilion on the Park. And he was just a guy who got flavour. He could just extract so much flavour out of food. His cooking had a beautiful sort of refined nature to it, but somehow he got what people wanted to eat. He could translate that onto a plate, and he delivered it, and still to this day his ice creams are still some of the best that I've ever had. Maybe that's just because I love ice cream, but he was just great. He really understood flavor more than a lot of chefs that I've ever met. And then I sort of, after that, I worked for a guy over in Perth. I spent two and a half years over in Perth and followed a girl over there. Had a sort of interesting time in Perth, but I worked for about 12 months or more with a guy called Neil Jackson, who's now retired. And he sort of did some quirky sort of food. I suppose in a way he was a bit of a lover of Charlie Trotter at the time and that sort of, kind of a bit sort of quirky combinations, but technically he was just brilliant. He had, done his apprenticeship at the Savoy Hotel. His butchery skills were amazing. But he was just a really giving guy. Like, I was this older commie or demi or whatever you wanted to call me in this small restaurant in Perth. And I was running the pastry section, and I'd waited for an opportunity to work for him because, opportunities in Perth didn't, good opportunities in Perth at the time, sort of 1998, didn't come up very often, let me tell you. And so I'd gone in there and he taught me how to debone pig's trotters. I just went in there. I knew somebody who knew him and I said, oh, look, can I come in and learn how to do that? And so I was sort of next cab off the rank in getting a job And he was just a really cool guy. Like he was about my age now, a little bit older. And, you know, we used to listen to, you know, I think it was Moby was coming out at the time and Groovermata. And we were listening to guys like that and, you know, listening to sort of other music in the kitchen during the day. And he'd sort of buying different chocolates for me to use and to work with. And he just was really giving. He was just a lovely, lovely man to work for. And we're still mates. But he's sort of, you know, pretty much retired, I think, these days. And he still does a bit of work consulting stuff for people. But he was amazing. And then I sort of came back from WA after the Olympics. And I ended up working at 41 Restaurant for Dietmar Sawyer. And that was just phenomenal. That was just an amazing job. I spent, you know, almost 2 years there, and I think that was in hours terms probably the equivalent of about three and a half years, that kind of thing. But you know, worth every cent. You know that I got out of it. It was, and I worked with Jocks on Frillo there. He was my chef de cuisine. So yeah, it was a pretty interesting time, but, you know, you're doing sort of, honestly, you're doing 70 hours a week, every single week. But you know, I walked away from there being able to fillet fish, you know, properly and debone rabbits and hares and all sorts of things. There just wasn't, you weren't scared of any sort of style of service or, you know, technically it was a really brilliant place to work and you know, but it was brutal as well. It was really quite brutal. But I'm not sure whether I'd recommend it these days. But I'd certainly, you know, I got a huge amount out of it. And I loved it. So yeah, I suppose they were the three major things past Trezzini's that really influenced me greatly before going on to Otto. So.
Well, Otto has been a real feature of the Sydney dining landscape for a couple of decades now, and you're at the helm for almost a decade. Take us back into the kitchen there. Do you have any memories or real special moments that you could tell us about the period of time there?
Oh, just so many. What a restaurant. And still to this day, I mean, Richard just does an amazing job there. He just continued it on. He's such a good cook. It's unbelievable. But look, I think what Otto was then, and I'm having eaten there a few times now, it still is the epitome of what service and hospitality is about. You know, it's that kind of place where you just want to make sure that, you know, anybody has a really memorable experience. I mean, I cooked for all sorts of people, from movie stars and rock stars and, you know, political dignitaries. But I think the thing that typified it for me, and it's probably one of the things I'm most proud of, is, you know, I walked out of there one day at sort of about 6 o'clock, I think it was, and I was walking down the wharf, and there was this kid in the restaurant, and I've told the story a few times, but he was sitting down, it was about six or just after. He's sitting down with this girl. He might have been about 20, if that, 19, 20. He was reading this wine list. I was just watching him. He's reading this wine list like it was just, I don't know, some, you know, scientific manual that he'd never come across before. And yet he's dining with this gorgeous, you know, looking girl. And so I just, you know, got my, you know, my cube of a mobile phone, as they were back then, and I gave the restaurant a call, and I said to Leanne, who always answered the phone, I said, look, you see those two kids there, let's give them two glasses of champagne, let's put down a Reggiano plate with some olives and handmade Grissini on it, and let's just start that night off for these guys really, really well. And I just watched it, and he got two glasses of champagne in front of him, and he got this sort of starting plate. He didn't know where they were coming from, and you could just see his shoulders relax. You could see this girl going, "My God, who am I eating with?" and that kind of set the tone for their night. And that wasn't an unusual experience for a lot of people at that restaurant. And I still think it holds on to it today. It's the backbone of what it is. It is the quintessential hospitality restaurant, and some of the people that I worked there, whether that being in the kitchen and or floor, were just some of the best, you know, at that style of food, to be quite honest. So, or style of service and food and business. You know, it was amazing, amazing place, great time, really good time there.
It was the first time you were at the helm of a restaurant that was feeding up to 450 guests a day, and it sort of steered the rest of your career to do really huge venues. What did you learn from that time of having such a big brigade and feeding that many people?
Oh, well, first of all, big brigade, look after them, work out your rosters really well, rotate them, give people weekends off, make sure they get nights off, make sure they get, you know, tips, make sure, you know, you're continually moving them around the kitchen and keeping their development happening so that you can maintain that brigade, because it doesn't matter where you work, but in bigger brigades in particular, you need to have a hardcore group of people that stay with you for long periods of time to make sure the mechanism works consistently. And so you have to, you know, make sure that you're managing it all the time. And also just make sure that when you're looking for staff, you're looking for you're looking under every single rock, you know, whether it's Seek or whether it's, you know, a random email, whether it's somebody who walks through the door, you know, always take an interest, always, you know, I think you first of all, you started off, when I started off, you know, you'd be looking for John Smiths, and then you realize there aren't that many John Smiths out there, and you open your spectrum up of people and you realize there's amazing cooks from all around the world. And you know, today we're blessed to have, you know, something like 18 or 19 different nationalities in our kitchen, you know. So, you know, and to give people opportunities, really make sure that someone who's keen, who's not that great, you can build them into something that is fantastic. You know, you just can't operate a revolving door. You have to give people opportunities. And the more you kind of take, what's the word I'm looking for? When you take a little bit of a hit to start with, in terms of, you know, a bit of rocky road with people where it's, you know, you got to invest that time into someone. Once you get past that, you know, you really get a lot more out of it than you think. So, you know, you see so many people go, oh, you know, after a few months or 2 months, you know, they go, oh, you're no good. It's not true. It's about how much you're willing to invest into those people and how much your team is investing into that as well. So, you know, we hold the point, it won't be up to us that someone will fail in our kitchen. You know, we will give them every single opportunity to be a success.
You had a dramatic change in your career, moving to the nation's capital, executive chef of the National Gallery and the staff catering at Parliament House. How different was that world compared to Otto on the Wharf?
Well, yes, different in terms of it wasn't quite the most glamorous role, I suppose, but you know, there were some other pieces in that that I was managing as well. The catering or the sort of cafeteria style stuff at the Defence Department administrative buildings as well. And I think, you know, it was just another sort of growth path for me. You know, I'd sort of been in this really high profile role at Otto, and I was offered this role that was really managing multiple outlets and all the various things that go in there into each one of them. And there was functions, there was one day we'd be, you know, delivering a function for 300 people at the National Gallery. The next day you're, you know, helping make muffins and sandwiches and at one of the administrative buildings. And then you've got an ever evolving menu at our restaurant. And so it was just a really amazing opportunity to, you know, create a different experience for myself and put a few more feathers in the cap in terms of what I could do within my career. And I think most people looked at it going, what is this guy doing? You know, why is he moving to Canberra? This is completely ridiculous. And I really got it, you know. But at the end of the day, you know, I'd sort of been at Otto for 8 years at the time, and I just needed a really different challenge, and I didn't feel like I needed the intense scrutiny of Sydney in another restaurant. I felt like I needed something that was just really different, and I got that, and it was amazing. I got to work again with some really interesting people who were great at so many different things. You know, like I got to work with your brother, who was a fantastic cook. I mean, that was the highlight, Anthony. You know,
he'll be pleased to hear that.
But you know, he was awesome, and guys who could deliver functions, and you know, guys who knew how to deliver, or chefs who knew how to deliver, you know, to upwards of, you know, a few thousand meals a day through administrative cafes. You know, like it's such a different world, and it was a great opportunity, and I got to live somewhere else, which I really enjoyed, and I've still got great mates down there. You know, Ben Willis from Aubergine, I went and did a couple of nights with him when he was short staffed, so, and we became mates, and so you end up just having this lovely spectrum of friends within your industry in all sorts of different parts of the world or the country, and that's a really nice thing, I think. So yeah, you know, rather than just staying in one place for eons. So yeah.
What brought you back to Sydney? You came back a couple of years before going to Cafe Sydney, but what triggered the move?
Well, the mother of my daughter, Naomi, she really wanted to come back to Sydney, which is fair enough. I think, you know, I had a health issue. I actually had a full hip replacement on the right-hand side that needed to be done. Yeah, I was living in a bit of pain, and that was just due to lifestyle and probably playing too much football for too long and all sorts of things. I mean, everything else is perfectly fine except for this particular hip for whatever reason. But so I needed to take a bit of a break and get that done and get that right. So I did that. We were actually planning to go overseas for probably 6 months or so, but that sort of put that on the back burner. And I think that was really probably about it. You know, Naomi really wanted to come back and start doing what she wanted to be doing. And I was perfectly fine with that. And we've been down there for, I think, 2.5 years. It was a great experience. And look, you know, there was probably a few things that were happening sort of internally in the company that made it a bit easier to sort of move. But, you know, it was just really coming home and probably being around our sort of support network as well, whether that been family and friends. When you've got a young child that's only one, you know what that's like. You've got twins. Help, help. So yeah, that was really the long and the short of it, really.
You spent a bit of time at Daltyne House, but the majority of your time back in Sydney has been at Cafe Sydney. Tell us about getting that role and the pressure of such an iconic venue when you first came on board.
You know, it was strange. I was walking down the street and I got this phone call from the recruiter because he, you know, had been given my name through another industry person and they knew that I was free. I ended up having a 45-minute conversation while I was standing on the corner of George Street and King Street in the city. And I ended up meeting Jan. We had a really great conversation about the role. You know, she, I've got to say, has given me this opportunity to be an executive chef, to hold an executive role, but also be a single dad, enable me to be, you know, to have that aspect of my life, but still hold on to an amazing role. So that was probably the biggest part of moving back into that sort of style of role. And so that was sort of ticked. And then, you know, the conversation that she and I had in terms of how the kitchen needed to be operated and how it needed to develop and move forward, you know, seemed to be incredible synergy. They said just, you know, there was incredible synergies there. And we sort of got into it and I think, you know, the process lasted about 10 days. We signed up and I started, you know, very quickly. And you know, it's sort of, you know, she has just been an instrumental part of my development over the last sort of 7 years of being there. She's certainly a cracking human being and someone whose management has helped me develop you know, to another level. I think she's remarkable.
Yeah. Well, tell us a bit about the kitchen and what food you're doing there. What does it take to deliver food at the level that you're dealing with like 600 covers a day and to be such a renowned restaurant as well?
Keep it simple to a great degree. Use amazing produce. We're really blessed with what we get access to, especially with that volume. You need to, I didn't tell you all the secrets, but what you need to do is you can walk to a lot of different restaurants and you can have a look at their menus and you can sort of, you know, exactly which suppliers they're using. You know, it's a real sort of an easy menu to work out. But when you sort of come to Cafe Sydney, what you want is you want to have a whole lot of different backstories to your food, like anybody does. But the beauty of running something like that is that you can take up the production of one particular item from someone, or you can be one of a few people who get a particular product because you can constantly support using all of it. And so you can create a very unique menu within the context of a high volume restaurant, and that enables you, the diner, to come in and have a very unique experience, and one that's amazing because the quality of produce is second to no other restaurant in Sydney, I can tell you. Like, people just, whether that be all of the Australian cheeses that we use, whether that be the meat, the seafood and the fruit and veg, I mean, it's really great. So I think that's the first thing. You need to have great quality product. And then all those other things that I was saying about running the staff, they're really critical, making sure that you are constantly manoeuvring people. So the first thing that we say to people when they come on board is we say, look, we view your employment here as about a two-year experience. If you don't see it as that, that's perfectly fine with us. Go choose something else. But by doing that, it establishes what you want for that person, you know, what you want for the business as well, and how you're going to do that. And so that when someone's with you, they have a clear path of, you know, how their development is going to happen. And so that enables you to keep people, I think, really for long periods of time, and that enables incredible consistency. And then during that period of time, you can work on people. It takes a couple of years until you've got a really good technical level within the business that enables you to do, you know, a few bits and pieces that are a little bit more interesting than what you would expect from a place that's high volume. So, you know, it's this constant, you know, amount of energy that you've got to put into it. So I suppose that's really how it works, to be quite honest.
A part of taking the role at Cafe Sydney was to have that life-work balance that you wanted. What sort of impact has that had on you, having that balance?
So there's definitely a bigger balance. I mean, you're still at executive level, so there still are those hours that you've got to achieve, I think. But when, you know, I have my daughter, you know, when she's with me, you know, I have time. You know, I have time to be present. I have time to go to the football games. I have time to, you know, go to the plays or the musicals. I can go pick her up on certain days, or if she's sick, you know, and she's with me, then I just have to say to Jan, look, you know, Luna's sick. And she goes, no problem. And we'll see you tomorrow. Let us know what's going on. So, look, to have that balance is phenomenal. It just enables you to connect with not only family but friends, and to have some semblance of normality that other people get as well. So it's really nice. It's good, but at the same time, you still have a very dynamic and interesting role that you know that you have to be always concentrating on. So yeah,
you mentioned a bit earlier the crazy hours you did as a young chef, and those times have changed. And you found work-life balance for yourself. How do you create that for so many in a massive brigade and give them the work-life balance that they need?
Well, look, I mean, I think that we're fortunate enough to have the business that enables us to employ the amount of people that we need. And that, for the most part, I think people are really pulling down very, very standard hours. But to do that, you have to, you look at someone's week as a Monday to Friday or a Tuesday to Saturday or a Wednesday to Sunday, and you rotate people to doing a succession of days or a succession of nights. If someone's got something that's important to them, whether it be a mate's 21st or a family event that you really want them to be a part of, they just have to come and tell you, give me a couple of weeks' notice so we can factor it into the roster and we'll make it happen. I think in 7 years I've only denied one or two requests, and that was because they were late. And we already had people who'd already made requests, and we just couldn't shift things around in terms of the experience level in the kitchen for that particular shift on that particular night or something like that. So I think you just got to make that stuff happen for people. And if you do, people really appreciate it.
Well, it's winter and a little bit chillier. What's a dish that you can tell us about, an ingredients you're using sort of right now that you're really excited about?
Oh, what am I excited about? Chestnuts. Chestnuts have just, they've been around for a bit, but probably the dessert that I'm really loving, and I posted it recently on Instagram, was this Paris Bresse, which is essentially is a donut-shaped choux pastry, which is got this craquelin on top, which is like a sugar bake, which makes the outside of the choux paste become really crunchy and sugary. And then in the middle, we're doing a chestnut cremo with grated chestnut and apple puree and these cinnamon meringues, and it's a pretty classic dessert. But it's, I think, and we're also using chestnut with a quail dish at the moment, and quail with chestnut and potato puree and pancetta and burnt sage butter. So those sorts of ingredients. Quinces are on at the moment, and sort of all that kind of thing. And you have to work a little bit harder in autumn and winter, to sort of, I think, to hold the food where it needs to be, because you don't have the luxury of, berries and passion fruits and, green vegetables coming out of everywhere. Sort of spring, you've got zucchini flowers and you've got broad beans and you've got asparagus coming and all those sorts of things. Winter requires a little bit more effort, but it's still a great season to be cooking,
You've had an incredible and varied career, from added restaurants of influence to the nation's capital with the gallery and Parliament House, and one of Australia's most iconic venues, Cafe Sydney. What is it that you love about what you do?
Entertaining people. I don't think you can ever lose sight of the fact that the customer is always the most important person, or people. And I like giving them a good time. I mean, I think that people come in to celebrate birthdays, anniversaries, all sorts of things, or a business meal, or and people pay a lot of money for that experience these days. It hasn't got cheaper, that's for sure. And so I always really enjoy that aspect of it. I think it's the bit that kind of it sort of translates through everything. So the relationships that you have with producers, through to the relationship that you have with your customers or your guests, is they're the most important things to the success of your business. And I find those the most enjoyable, especially the older I get. You enjoy that sort of human interaction that you get through doing business in whichever form you're doing it. So yeah, I think that's probably the most enjoyable thing that I like these days, I've got to say. Yeah.
Well, James, we've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today to hear your story. And hopefully we can catch up again with you soon and hear a few more.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Anthony. Have a great day. Speak soon.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we share the stories of Australia's hospo community, suppliers and producers in search of hope during this pandemic. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.